So we have a different list of testifiers for later in the hearing, and I'll call the names and then who is on deck, so you'll be able to get up to the dais quickly, and that will allow for additional people to testify. And we have time limits that have been communicated to everybody who's making presentations. But before we get into that, we have minutes for the House Transportation Committee from February 20, our last meeting, February 20th. Representative Petersburg, you weren't here, but it's traditional that you...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly will move minutes. I wasn't here, so I'm hoping everybody else has read them and said if there's any issues, but I certainly can make the motion to approve them.
Okay, all discussion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. Before we call on MnDOT to give us an overview of this important transportation issue for the region, I wanted to call on Representative Sensenmura, who has really brought this issue to our committee and has been active in it. And if you wanted to make some quick introductory comments, that would be great.
Well, thank you, Chair Hornstein, for helping to put this hearing together. Thank you to our Senate colleagues that are joining us today. And most of all, thank you for the public for showing up for what I think is a really important conversation about the historical role that highways have played in our state. And I think the immense opportunity that we have moving forward to think about highways and planning differently and move in a different direction. I am a member of the Rethinking 94 PAC, which brings together elected officials from various levels of government that have a part of the highway that will be redesigned, spanning from a part of Minneapolis to St. Paul. And MnDOT is going through a process of really trying to understand the historical injustices that 94 caused for a number of communities and give alternatives for what planning for the highways of the future, planning for the streets of the future can look like. So I thought this was an important conversation to bring the Transportation Committee into. I think for both this individual highway, which holds so much significance and importance for communities, and I think for probably a lot of us who may take the highway and getting into the Capitol, but also for a broader conversation within our state about how do we plan and build highways differently moving forward. So thank you for MnDOT for being here today, and I hope this is just the first conversation of many as we look at highways across our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sensenmura. And just for a map for the morning, we'll have presentations from MnDOT and a couple of stakeholders in this PAC process that Representative Sensenmura described. And then we'll have an extended period of time for questions and answers from committee members and then some members of the public. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just as kind of getting background information. Is there some impetus or are you thinking about moving something forward this year?
There's no bill this year. We're not moving anything forward this year. However, because this has been such an important issue in the community, and we haven't, this I-94 process has been going on for several years, and thought it was important for the community and the public to be aware of what's going on, particularly in terms of MnDOT's process.
All right, thank you.
So with that, we'll start our hearing with Eric Rudin and John Dukic from MnDOT. Or others from MnDOT. welcome, and please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair, committee members, thanks for the invitation today to present to this very important group. My name is Sheila Kelpie. I work for the Minnesota Department of Transportation. I'm the Deputy District Engineer. And with me today I have
Melissa Barnes. I also work for MnDOT. I'm the Rethinking I-94 Project Director.
I appreciate Sensenmura's representation of the PAC meeting that many of us have been involved in since a healing ceremony that occurred in 2015 with the Rondo community. was at that meeting where our former commissioner acknowledged the past harms of the construction of the interstate system in the 1960s. At that moment, he committed that we, Department of Transportation, would do business better and differently, which was a highlight to the fact of this long-term engagement effort that we started in 2016 to connect with community members along the corridor, those that use the corridor, and commute. As I mentioned, Rethinking I-94 is a long-term process to engage communities that live, work, and play along the corridor to promote effective movement of people and goods and supporting community goals. That's what we listened to for 2 years with the community in 2016 to 2018. We established what we call the livability framework, where the hopes, dreams, and desires of what community members along the corridor were hoping to see in our transportation projects and our planning process. We've taken that work, and Melissa will highlight how we've incorporated that into our evaluation criteria for the future of this I-94 corridor. MnDOT's responsibility for the I-94 corridor includes preserving and repairing bridges, walls, pavement, and enhancing mobility, safety, and connectivity. Rethinking I-94 looks to enhance the connectivity and address identification of the transportation needs along the corridor. In doing so, Rethinking I-94 works to ensure that residents have a meaningful voice and thoughtful voice in our transportation of decisions that affect their lives and their communities. MnDOT recognizes that the actions taken when we first constructed the freeway has put the whole area in a disruptive state, right? And we know that for the last 60 years we've built and tried to gain that trust that we lost at the time in the 1960s. Those impacts are felt still real and within our communities and our agency today. Our work the last few years has focused on understanding the communities in these neighborhoods and ensuring these voices and perspectives are heard throughout the project. Melissa?
Thanks, Sheila. Thank you, committee. I just want to set us in where we are in space and time. So this is our project limits. We go from 35W and Highway 55 in Minneapolis over to Marion Street in St. Paul. 94 runs 7.5 miles, and we kind of cover a quarter mile both north and south of the corridor. Just to give you a sense of some of what's going on out here, there's approximately 35,000 residents, 1,300 businesses, and 24,000 people employed just within that quarter mile of this corridor. In addition, the program area is found to have a daily traffic volumes between 114,000 and 167,000, depending on where you are along the corridor. So also to set us where what we're doing, we are in an environmental impact statement. It is the highest level of review from the federal government. It's part of the National Environmental Policy Act, otherwise known as NEPA. And it sets governments up to review projects in accordance with environmental, social, and economic impacts. It has a thorough, balanced, and systematic process that evaluates alternatives, avoids impacts at all costs, but then mitigates them when they're unavoidable. It also incorporates inputs from multiple agencies, units of government, and the public. So right now we're in scoping, really high level, like 30,000 feet. We've developed a purpose, need, and goals. We've developed alternatives, and we are currently evaluating those alternatives. So we haven't made any decisions. We released the alternatives to the public this past summer. We are working toward the public comment period, which will end up with a finalized scoping document. That scoping document may eliminate some of those alternatives, and then we'll move into 3 years of much further analysis of social, economic, and environmental issues. It takes 3 years. We'll get to an approved document. Then we have a vision for the corridor. What will the corridor look like? How many lanes? Where will the interchanges be? Where will the bicycle and pedestrian crossings be? But then we need to move into tier two. We need to actually create construction plans. It will likely be not one, but multiple projects along 7.5 miles. That's a long corridor. So we'll implement those in order that makes sense. And there's no funding for anything right now. We don't have funding because we don't know what we're going to build. So that will be programmed after we figure out kind of more what we are going to build. So the purpose of the Rethinking I-94 program will improve mobility for people, goods, on, along, and across the corridor in a way that facilitates community connections for all modes, enhance the safety for people and goods on, along, and across the 94 corridor for all modes, address aging infrastructure condition within the 94 corridor, and support transportation objectives consistent with adopted state and regional plans. Alternatives that move forward also need to meet the needs. Some of the needs that are in the 94 corridor, walking and biking is uncomfortable both along and across the 94 corridor, and also risky in some situations. Safety for motorized vehicles, cars, freight, and transit. This corridor is above the critical crash rate. Infrastructure condition, this road was built in the early 60s. It's coming to the end of its life cycle. Bridges, drainage, retaining walls, other infrastructure are all in need of being kept up. And then mobility, the crash problems can lead to inconsistencies in travel times. There's congestion, both along and across. As we spoke to people, as Sheila mentioned early in the process, even before the environmental process, we heard that a lot of folks were interested in things beyond transportation. So a livability framework was developed, and goals were created that we will evaluate the alternatives per these goals. That includes community connections, public health and the environment, economics, sense of place, safety and beyond safety that we measure in our books, but safety, a feeling of safety, and equity. We aim to develop and execute a community-based approach focused on reconnecting neighborhoods, revitalizing communities, and ensuring residents have a meaningful voice in transportation decisions that affect their lives. So we released 10 alternatives this summer. They're available online. I don't have them here today. But there's a wide variety of alternatives under consideration. We have alternatives that do nothing. We have alternatives that turn the freeway into an at-grade signalized roadway. We have alternatives that reduce the freeway. We have alternatives that expand the freeway and kind of everything in between. So we are looking holistically to evaluate alternatives and their impacts along the spectrum of possibilities. These were developed in partnership with community members, technical experts across a wide variety of local, state, and federal agencies, but as well as with the public. They combine roadway and transit ideas. Again, they're really high level. It's a picture in time. It doesn't include any information about interchanges or intersections. Those are all next steps. After we released the alternatives, that was in June of 2023, we did some pretty extensive engagement. So you can see the numbers up here, but we are particularly proud of the 1,100 folks that we engaged with in one-on-one conversations. We had a survey, we had prints, digital media, and went to community organizations, as well as we meet with what we call our community leaders, which is a group of about 47, 50 leaders, stakeholder groups that are connected to the corridor in some way. What did we hear? So when we went out, we were really asking, what are we missing? The alternatives are without context at this time. We haven't evaluated them. There's no impacts to be tied to them. That's our next step. So we really asked, what are we missing? And we're very thankful for the feedback that we received. We heard that we need to continue to coordinate with Reconnect Rondo. They have a process moving forward looking at a land bridge, and we are continuing to coordinate with them, work with them, and understand their process as it relates to any alternatives that might come out of ours. We also heard that there's interest in land bridges beyond just their process. So we've created a working group within MnDOT to help develop guidelines and future policy related to land bridges, LIDs, and stitches. Stitches are just really wide bridges. We keep hearing about walking and biking. We are committed to incorporating walking and biking in all future alternatives, both along and across. Again, that's next steps. We hear about the aesthetics of 94. We will be having an extensive outreach to determine what we call visual quality along this corridor. And then opportunities for technology, solar arrays, things like electric vehicle charging stations, intelligent transportation systems, all of that will be incorporated as we move forward. So again, we have 10 alternatives. We're going to look at them for the purpose and need. Does it meet the purpose and need that we talked about? Social, economic, and environmental resources. How does it negatively impact things like environmental justice communities, historic properties, water, air quality? our goals that I talked about. How does it meet those, and is it doing something good? And then additional considerations. How much does it cost to build? How much does it cost to maintain? And how does it relate to our state and regional plan? We'll likely come out with fewer alternatives that move forward into our Tier 1. But again, those are next steps as we evaluate. So again, we're refining and evaluating those alternatives, developing that scoping document, and then we will move into engagement. We're continuing to meet with partner agencies, neighborhood groups, schools, and businesses. We've developed different campaigns to get more feedback. We are hiring people from the community around the corridor to help us connect further with the communities. We are involving youth in multiple ways, including bringing in high school interns. And then we continue to work with our community leaders who provide really great feedback on how to outreach more effectively.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes. Members, what we're going to do is hear a couple more presentations, and then we'll have some extended opportunity for Q&A. So next up, I believe we have Keith Baker and Fatima Moore. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Marvin Anderson. I'm chairman of the board of Reconnect Rondo, and I'm here with Keith Baker, the executive director of Reconnect Rondo. 40 years ago, I was so excited when I was appointed the state law librarian. The state law library at the time was located at 117 University Avenue, which is the old Ford building. As I drove up today, the Ford building is gone. And it was something in history, but I enjoyed my 23 years with the state, and I always enjoyed coming before a committee to exchange information about the state law library. But I'm here today on behalf of Reconnect Rondo. And I'm here today with deep gratitude and a profound sense of accomplishment. 2 years ago, this esteemed committee allocated $6.2 million in support of our vision to revitalize the Rondo community. And we are honored to be here today to provide a comprehensive report on the transformative journey that these funds have enabled. Since the appropriation, Reconnect Rondo has become a catalyst for positive change, stimulating a flurry of activity that will leave an indelible mark on the people, the landscape, the community, the economic, social, and cultural fabric of Rondo. Through careful planning, strategic partnerships, and community engagement, we have harnessed these funds to initiate projects that go beyond infrastructure. They represent a commitment to growth, prosperity, and restorative justice for the residents of Rondo. Today, we present to you the tangible outcomes of your investment: a renewed infrastructure, vibrant public spaces, economic opportunities, and an enhanced social and cultural outlook. The impact of your decision extends far beyond dollars and cents. It has revitalized the community, rekindled hope, and set the stage for sustainable development. We wish to express our deepest gratitude to the Transportation Committee for their foresight and commitment to the Reconnect Rondo project. Your support has been the bedrock upon which this transformative initiative stands. You have not just provided funds, you have empowered us as your agents of change, and for that, we are truly grateful. Before concluding, I would like to take a moment to acknowledge the exemplary leadership of Chairman Hornstein. Your dedication and vision has been instrumental in guiding this committee, and we extend our heartfelt appreciation to you for your service. As you embark on a well-deserved retirement, we wish you continued success in your future. Now I present our Executive Director, Keith Baker, who will provide the report.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson, and Chair Hornstein and committee members. Just to clarify, the 6.2, it came through the tax omnibus bill. And we were really grateful for initial support of the Transportation Committee and others as part of the state legislature. Let me just really kind of set the ground rule a little, the framing of what's occurred here to date. If you can imagine African-American members of what we now know as St. Paul began to migrate as early as 1830. Through that time, you can just understand that after 120 years, the fabric of the community had been established, the social, cultural, economic, civic fabric. If you can just also imagine in 2009 when the Central Light Rail Corridor was going through, there were no stops in Rondo. It always almost felt like a repeat of what had taken place in prior years. The community rose up, pushed back against the process, and began to think about how do we reclaim the land that was taken back during the destruction in 1956. I want to fast forward you to the appropriation of $6.2 million, and as Mr. Anderson had mentioned, what we plan to do is provide you with an update of where we are in terms of the pre-planning. So we've been really vigorously involved in pre-planning since 2022. Just imagine a decision, an intentional decision, a political decision in 1956. Actually, the process began much earlier than that. A growing middle class is established between 1930 and 1956. The northern route was the Pierce-Butler route. But instead, the only place that African Americans were allowed to live was within this geographic space of Rondo, this beloved space of Rondo. Yet there was a decision to go specifically through Rondo, the only place in which was a foothold for the community overall. Bear in mind, as that was taking place, urban renewal was also emerging. And urban renewal was a participant in that without question. It created root shock. It dispersed the community. Undermined the very social, economic, civic, spiritual fabric of the community. Profound emotional impacts of that fabric certainly took place. It undermined trust not only in one another, but trust within institutions. And so we're very pleased to be partnering with not only the Department of Transportation, but working closely with the city, the county, and Met Council as well. Bear in mind that we've conducted a number of studies, and I just want to point out a couple of them in particular. The Past Prosperity Study, Restorative Development Study, Anti-Displacement Study, the Feasibility Study, how the financing of such a development can occur, not only the structure but also the development on top. We've invested a tremendous amount of expertise and community involvement through that process. The result, when we think about this idea of root shock, by each of these measures, the community of Rondo ranks net negative. There is no positive except for the spirit of the community itself that remains, remnants of the community that remains. But you can see that we have a clear goal, getting from net negative to net positive, leveraging a transportation element for community building. Reconnect Rondo is leading a restorative movement to reignite an African-American cultural enterprise district, which was Rondo before the freeway came through. We're committed to really leading the nation on how transportation investment can emerge as a very positive aspect of growing communities. Imagine the cost. Well, from our analysis and our feasibility study, which I indicated we had already performed, 13 to 15 million of pre-development work. That 6.2 was a contributing factor to the pre-planning studies that we've conducted. When we think about the cost of the structure itself, 313 million, and we think about the infrastructure bill that's recently been passed about the same year, 2021, at the federal level, we all know that 80% of transportation projects can be paid for using federal resources, and that the state would only be asked and invited to invest in the community of Rondo at a tune of $63 million. It's a tremendous investment when you think about the loss. If the community had not, or if the housing had not been taken within Rondo, the current value today would be $250 million of past wealth to the community itself. It's an extraordinary amount of money. Therefore, the idea of the state contributing $63 million, does not address the full nature of the loss, but certainly sets it on the path correctly. So let's talk about that 80-20 split. $250 million can come through, again, the Inflation Reduction Act and the IIJA. And it could bring about, again, addressing the building of the structure at $313 million. The kinds of activities that $313 million would address is planning studies. Again, as Sheila had mentioned, there's the NEPA process that MnDOT is conducting along the entirety of the corridor, and there's the NEPA process that we have taken on responsibility for doing ourselves. At some point, we'll need to coordinate. But that NEPA really ensures that it doesn't get missed the way it got missed on the Central Light Rail Corridor project when there were no stops identified within Rondo. What are the possibilities? What are the opportunities? 375 housing units, retail and marketplace, about 100,000, 108,000 office retail market square foot. New jobs, 1,800 jobs can be created. Institutional space like a library or a museum or other kinds of amenities that really help communities build forward. It can increase city revenue. Not only city revenue, if we can imagine the incubation of businesses and taxes being paid by those that are rising up and economic opportunities, it benefits the state across the board. So this is just not a social service program. This is an economic opportunity for the state of Minnesota, and I would argue the region, and we're leading the nation in this regard. Here's where we are in our process after having conducted a number of studies, and let me just point out the studies. A place-based study on gentrification, Rondo Community Land Bridge Feasibility Study, Past Prosperity Study and Restorative Development Modeling Study, a Health Impact Assessment, Rondo 4P Modeling, and by the way, we've partnered throughout this with the Urban Land Institute, and as you all know, they carry a great degree of expertise that lends itself to validating the things that we've put forward in our study. A Digital Technology Broadband Connectivity Study. And then finally, as I've mentioned before, an anti-displacement study. So when we think about restorative development, what really are we talking about? Well, let me frame it for you. Our study area is Hamlin all the way to the state capital to the east. The geographic blue space that you see there is really what we've defined, at least preliminarily, as the enterprise district for African Americans. We have six identified areas and elements within our study. Our neighborhood restorative development study. That's the transportation and mobility, that's parks and open space, that's economic opportunity, that's housing opportunity, environmental resilience, and history, culture, and arts. You can see it's quite comprehensive.
You could just wrap up too.
Indeed. The comprehensive study that we have in our restorative development integrates anti-displacement, the restorative development, and the neighborhood plan. We've conducted this beginning in 2022. You can see that it's carried forward through December 2023. I'll just finish up by indicating that equity is the building of resiliency and sustainable or resilient and sustainable communities that address climate change, better health outcomes, and improved quality of life overall. I'll conclude by simply indicating we've submitted just recently in September $100 million grant to the neighborhood and equity grant at the federal level in partnership with the Rondo Community Land Trust. We're hoping to continue our momentum that we've begun thus far. So thank you so much for our opportunity.
Thank you for your presentation. And finally, we have Alex Burns and Nasmin Hirsi. They could come up. And then we'll have Q&A from the committee. You have about 12 minutes for your presentation. Looks like you have a lot of folks, so.
Thank you.
While you're getting set up, I want to welcome Senator Dibble and Senator Jasinski. Good to see you again.
Nice to be here.
You don't quite have the technology that the Senate has. But we made it work. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Jose Sayas-Caban. I am the executive director at Our Streets Minneapolis. I am joined by Lucy Gibson from Tool Design and John Commerce from Visible City. We are here to talk about our work and research on the Rethinking I-94 project and introduce you to a high-level overview of the results of this report. Given the limited time, we will be following up with this presentation and a more detailed report via email. Before turning it over to Lucy, I'd like to provide some background. This is the Cedar Riverside neighborhood as it was and how it is today. As we all here know, the highway divided and destroyed. As Loyal Zimmerman puts it, we know that you are reasonable people and someone has to pay the price of progress. The reason why BIPOC communities were so heavily impacted by highways is part of a tapestry of harms starting with racial covenants. Over 36,000 have been discovered, forcing BIPOC people to live in concentration. They were zoned in areas called slums, reserved for what this map calls Negroes and those who are foreign-born. They were redlined, and as we can see in this North Minneapolis example, labeled as undesirable. In the 1950s, the then Highway Department, now MnDOT, introduced highways as a solution. They promised to improve property values, traffic, and air pollution, but the realities were quite the opposite. Racial covenants, this is the story of transportation in Minnesota. The impacts of I-94 stretch across the Twin Cities. And racial covenants were so effective in forcing the concentration of BIPOC communities that by the time the highways were built, they landed directly on the four highest concentration of Black Americans in the Twin Cities. For 200 years, since the dispossession of native lands, communities like Cedar Riverside, Rondo, and all others on the Rethinking I-94 project have been under the constant duress of displacement and disinvestment. The harms did not stop there. Today, these communities endure the worst air quality, the highest asthma hospitalization rates, the lowest life expectancy at birth, and the highest poverty rates. Beyond that, the Twin Cities has one of the largest gaps in white-to-black home ownership in the country, and one of the largest disparities in property values as well. The Twin Cities Boulevard project is an effort to expand community imagination about what is possible with the I-94 trench, and this report will help show that traffic, land use, housing, commerce, accessibility, health, and climate determinants can all improve if we focus on putting communities over highways. Just recently, we piloted a data collection tool so that we can start to demonstrate where people who support highway to boulevard conversion live. Here is a small sample. And since we began, we've knocked over 30,000 doors and continue to reach more people to make sure that every community member can legitimately consider and learn how a highway conversion can impact their everyday lives. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Lucy.
Thank you. I want to start with some of our concerns that we've had as we've started to review the I-94 project. The first is a lack of transparency. One of our first things we're interested in understanding the transportation modeling that's being used to evaluate all the options, including the ones that grade. And we were met with delays, refusal, and eventually being charged over $1,000 to get some computer files. When we looked at the modeling, we found that it's really not up to the job of projecting the kind of changes in infrastructure that a boulevard conversion would bring, because it's looking at static assignment, something used in the 70s and not for today. Further, the evaluation project is not reflective of the community values and all the issues that really need to be addressed. And it's worth noting that the interstate highway system originally was not intended to go through cities. It was going to go up to and around cities with a network of boulevards getting people in and out of the city and through. And that has a lot of wisdom that we really need to be considering. We've taken a deep dive on how people use the corridor, and this does not conflict with anything that MnDOT's found. It's used mostly for very short trips. The average trip length on this part of I-94 is 4 miles. A quarter of the trips are less than 2 miles. The I-94 itself results in a barrier for north-south movements. Almost as many people are trying to move across as alongside it. And we really need to look at how it's used. This is a scatter plot of where trips are going to and from I-94. These are local trips. They're not long-distance cross-country trips. They can be served by local street network that's well-designed and multimodal. It's also really important as to get a fair evaluation of the at-grade options is that the traffic modeling reflect the actual real-world response that people make to changes in highway capacity. There's a lot of ways people adapt to these kind of changes. We've seen it again and again with both freeway closures and freeway removals, and that needs to be done properly in this model. It's important to look at places that have been contemplating freeway removals. One is I-81 in Syracuse, where I-81 has gone through the city. It's going to be rerouted to outside the city, more in line with the traditional way of thinking about highways, and the community grid will be restored where the highway once stood. Another model we looked at is Octavia Boulevard in San Francisco. This is a very well-designed street that replaced the highway that collapsed in a freeway, and it's working really well. It carries a lot of vehicles, and it is an enhancement to the community. We're going to talk a little bit about what our report will have a lot of proposals for the Twin Cities Boulevard. One, I want to talk a little bit of how the network will work. Here's the existing conditions in the Cedar Riverside area. We are proposing a boulevard option, which would have a boulevard generally along the south side of the highway right-of-way, and then another street to carry, provide local access on the north side. We're also proposing a what we're calling the restored option, restoring the network that used to be there, which would be a smaller street on the south side, more in line with what was historically there, as well as a street on the north side. And we're going to show what this looks like. This is a existing conditions in the Cedar Riverside area. We built out these 3D models throughout the corridor to really understand how this would fit in and what the opportunities are. With the boulevard option, which includes bus lanes and 2 lanes of traffic in each direction, there is room for new land uses and new activities, and also the street. With the restored option, which would not have bus lanes and a little narrower street, there's even more space for new uses and new things to go on the corridor. Throughout this corridor, it's long, it's complex, there's a lot of constraints. In Prospect Park, things would look quite different, where there's more constraints for development, but basically the proposals would be more of a linear park with the greenway. In Rondo, where the corridor is quite wide, there's even more space. This is the boulevard option, how it would lay out, and then the restored option brings even more space for uses. And it's not at all incompatible with the land bridge if that's desired to have more of the through traffic underground and still provides room. So one of the most important things is for people to understand what this project would look like. There's not precedent for it in Minneapolis. There's few in the country, honestly. And so we've taken these 3D models and applied them to the real-world setting. This is what the boulevard would look like in the Cedar Riverside looking at downtown. This is below at the grade level where now the freeway is depressed. It would be brought up to grade. Development on the left, the boulevard on the right. Cedar Street would look quite different where it doesn't have to intersect a highway but rather could be reclaimed for development. Crossing the Mississippi River will be quite a different experience where people can enjoy the river and travel by all modes. And then here's Dale Street in Rondo where the current highway could be transformed to a place where people, businesses, homes, and parks could all take place. I'm not going to turn it over to John.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is John Commerce. I'm with Visible City. And our opportunity was to quantify how the I-94 right-of-way can both continue to perform the transportation function and produce substantially more community benefits by expanding use of this centrally located resource. So if you would, just join me for a moment in using Allianz Field, a landmark that we all recognize, to lend scale to this discussion, the opportunity. The punchline here is that you could fit 50 Allianz Field footprints into the project area that we've all been discussing today between Hiawatha and the state capitol. You could alternatively fit 446 footprints of this state office building in that geography. The point is that there's lots of space here to consider in one of the state's most well-connected central locations that's also really well served by infrastructure. So to estimate how much benefit can be unlocked through conversion to a boulevard, we sampled from local development patterns. And as you can see here, we used three models. One is a lower density model from the Cleveland Avenue footprint that is in Highland Park in St. Paul. We also used a modest density measure from Payne Avenue on the east side, and then a moderate density measure in Franklin Avenue in the Stevens Square area in Minneapolis. And those give us different levels of density, 5.9 dwelling units per acre, 7.5 dwelling units per acre, and 19.2 for the purpose of comparison. What we then did with that is we applied that, working with the transportation experts at Tool, including Lucy, we quantified that this would allow us, the conversion would allow us between 86 and 96 acres of right-of-way currently used for I-94. We could activate that space along with a boulevard for multimodal transportation. And what that creates is a resource that then we can use for housing, for parks, for commercial space, for job locations, for retail, for restaurants, for community services of all kinds. So finally, just in these 86 to 96 acres, what we believe to be a conservative projection of community benefits indicates between 500 and 1,800 housing units that you could add in this space, between 230 and 1,800 permanent jobs, that's not counting construction jobs, which also would be significant, somewhere between $150 million and $300 million of new market value and investment in this corridor. And finally, between $2.3 and $5.2 million in local property tax that would be collected annually. So thank you very much. I will turn it back to the rest of the group. We look forward to sharing our full report.
Thank you. We just have about a minute left for you.
So our key conclusions is I-94 is not serving the intensive purpose. The modeling is inaccurate, needs to be done better. The repurposing of the right-of-way has huge benefit, and Minnesota has an opportunity to set a national standard.
Yeah, I just have a clip from a board member of ours speaking about his experience, and I just have a 30-second remark. Is there audio?
So I actually live in St. Paul. Our family has been here since 1933. You know, all of my grandmother's eight brothers and sisters all ended up living in the Rondo neighborhood, and then were all subsequently displaced when I-94 went in. We all still live, you know, five or six blocks on either side of I-94. In our family, we have such fond memories of the Rondo neighborhood and its importance to Black culture and community in St. Paul. I think one of the things that's really challenging in the Rondo neighborhood right now is there are a couple small parks and places where people can get together and do family events. And I think if they had the opportunity to reimagine what the Twin Cities Boulevard project would look like, to reimagine St. Paul without 94, basically cutting a scar through the middle of the city, they would want to see it be a flourishing place. They'd want it to be green. They would want to have parks. They would want to have businesses. You know, our family had the first Black grocery store in the Rondo neighborhood. And so, you know, they also want money and jobs and newer, better housing and the full range of things that you could see there, including transportation, obviously, but to really rethink it as a space of community and a place where people can come together.
So,
thank you so much.
Just one short statement from us. The Twin City Boulevard project, to us, a highway to boulevard conversion is an opportunity for neighborhoods like Rondo to be reconnected and revitalized without rebuilding the highway. It's also an opportunity to repair the Cedar Riverside neighborhood and for all the impacted Twin Cities neighborhoods along the project corridor to benefit. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Member questions? imagine there's a few representing Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is actually, I have two questions for the department.
Okay. If MnDOT could come up.
I'll start asking the question while it's coming up, and it has to do with, I think as we start talking about this project, it's important for us to also have some historical background that we really haven't been presented up to this point. And so my question for the department is, if you could share with us, back when this was being developed and put forth, what was the purpose, what was generally expected to outcome from putting Highway 94 through? It's an arterial traffic way, and it's something that I believe was something intended for more than just involvement of any particular community. But so do you have that information as first question? I'll have
sure.
Chair, committee members, thank you for the question. Yes, I-94, and I'll help have Melissa help me as well here. I-94 is a major connector, right? It was the interstate system was built by the National Defense System, right? It's been around for a long, long time. It serves many different functions. When the construction happened on the interstate, much of the land use, communities, businesses, intermodal yards, freight, the state capital, all are located along the I-94 corridor. Much land use, traffic projections, all of that have been related to having the interstate I-94 in its current form or expanded in some regional modeling to stay in place. So I think that answers your question, but I'll have Melissa fill in.
Representative Petersburg, your follow-up.
Maybe later on you could tell us if that those have changed. But my second question is, we have heard that along this particular corridor, there are increases in health conditions and so forth, yet I know things like 694, 494 have a lot of cars too. Do we have a number of cars traveled on 494, 694, and 94? Are they comparable? And are we seeing the same health conditions along those roadways as well?
Chair, members, I believe that air quality is impacted by transportation. Some of the bills that have come up have recently looked to greenhouse gases, air quality, and those are linked. There's information on the Minnesota Department of Health website. This project will meet federal and local regulations regarding air quality impacts.
Thank you.
Petersburg.
You know, that's not really sufficient to the answer because I think it has quality issues. It's different than it does. And my question was, is 694 and 494, and do they have comparable to the number of cars and stuff driven on it? Do they have the same issues? Are we looking at a situation where we're going to claim this is an issue that needs to be addressed with all of our major corridors in the state?
Chair, yep, apologies. I do not know what the exact information is on 694. I don't know, Sheila, if you do.
We're happy to follow up with that additional information.
It would be good to get traffic counts for
yes.
the major freeways.
Thank you. We do. Yes.
Thanks for the questions, Representative Petersburg. Anyone else with a question? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a good one for the department. You're talking about how the use of a boulevard system or something like that, an at-grade system, would potentially reduce the vehicle miles traveled in the area. But a presenter had a quote that said that the traffic literally vanished. Does that mean that people stop driving their cars, or does that just mean they stop driving on that road? If we get rid of the freeway system here in 94, does that just push people out to other areas, artery ways and avenues, or does this actually do something to reduce people getting in their vehicle and driving? Because, you know, you could talk about, well, you know, if we get rid of this freeway system, then someone can walk, you know. Let's be real, I jump in my vehicle if I got to walk more than about a mile, right? I'm not going to walk a mile.
Yes, thank you. We will be bringing out modeling. We are working with the regional model to look at that. There will likely be regional impacts for anything that touches 94, and we want to understand those both at a local and regional level. So that is something that is part of our next steps. If it was to be turned into an at-grade arterial, more than likely some people may not make the same trips or may not make them in the same way. So that's something we're working to understand and making sure that we capture that type of information.
Follow-up.
This isn't a follow-up, Mr. Chair. Oh, boy. Lost my mic. That told me to tells me to stop talking. Question for the Rondo individuals. I was looking, and I saw that it says that there's a significant, it said inadequately compensation for the properties that were purchased. I've actually done some research on this, trying to find an actual number. Does someone have that number of what the average individual who was paid and how far away that was from an actual assessment of the value of the properties when it was taken in 1956?
Mr. Anderson.
Yes, thank you. Were you referring to the value of the homes?
Yeah, so when they were taken, the eminent domain that took the properties from these individuals, do we know what they were compensated based off of what the assessed value of their property was?
Yeah, there was, throughout the whole valuation process, there were many complaints that the homes were being undervalued, that they weren't getting full compensation for their homes. People would come into the homes and they would actually claim that the night before or a week before, property damage was done to their homes in order to get a lower valuation. There are all of these stories are there. Can we prove them? Can I point to them? No. But it was a general feeling throughout Rondo that the homes were not being fully valued. You have to remember, in Rondo, those weren't starter homes. Those were destination homes. Because of the restrictive covenants, the redlining, all of the other discriminatory practices, when a person moved in Rondo, they moved there to stay possibly forever. So they put their heart and their soul into these homes. That we call that, you know, that their internal and intrinsic value. So somebody comes and looks at your home, how many square footage? Do you have a garage attached? What's the age of your washer? That doesn't really get the value of that home to that person. The value of that home is the ability to pass it on to my grandchildren, to use it as an equity thing. So you look at value a different way in Rondo. So when people got a value, they were looking at the hardcore value. You don't have this, you don't have that. But what we did have in Rondo was our heart and our soul into those houses. And that was discounted. So you're going to leave that valuation upset. You didn't look at the way I did.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Yeah, thank you. I understand it. It's a very difficult thing to put, like what you're saying is there's a sentimental value that wasn't in the evaluation of the property. It was, this is what a garage is worth in this area. This is what a two-bedroom is worth in this area. And when you're forcing someone away from their property, the sentimental value is definitely inadequately assessed. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Senator Howe and then Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm not quite sure if this probably goes to MnDOT. You know, I avoid 94 the way it is. And for you folks in Rondo, I experienced MnDOT coming and taking some of my land, too. So I agree with you. You don't get what you think you have. So I the value is never what you think you should get. But for MnDOT, I avoid 94 now because I think it's congested. I take either 694 or 494. What is the proposed shift of traffic for other folks, especially, you know, when we come from outstate down into 94, to me, it's not well laid out, so I just avoid it because it's confusing. And if I use 94, I'm coming straight through. I'm going to the airport. That's where I'm going. So I either take 694 or I take 494. I believe that you're going to end up shifting more traffic to there. Is there any plans to actually do another ring around Minneapolis and St. Paul? Or are you going to continue to expand 694, 494 to take that increased traffic? Where is that going to go?
Chair,
Chair, committee members. Thank you for the question. I think one of the topics that you just mentioned about the traffic dispersion is something we need to spend some serious time thinking about. And each of these alternatives was highlighted in one of the comments from a previous presenter. You know, the regional model is set up a certain way. It's a static model. It takes into account regional plans. It takes into account what neighborhoods are planned, what neighborhoods exist, and also a traffic projection of people wanting to live within the Twin Cities or in Minnesota as a whole. It also takes into account people that just like you that are coming in for whether it's the college, some event, coming here to the Capitol today, or maybe going to church to and from. So there's many different ways that people utilize I-94, and to say we have it all figured out, I think in any of the alternatives would be a lie to you. We don't. What we know is if 94 changes capacity from what it is and what you described your experience on I-94, it will have regional impacts and it will have neighborhood impacts. What we don't know is what that is at this point. One of the elements that you mentioned is, you know, this land use. That is a hopes, dreams, desires. Again, the cities would need to change those land uses, different zoning within their communities. And then that rolls into the Met Council regional plan where we're kind of building into what that future plan looks like. So to say that I know, we don't have a plan for additional third ring around the Twin Cities. We don't. There's a lot of push from some folks to not build any additional capacity in our region. And those are real impacts that we need to take into account.
Quick follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that is short-sighted because if you want to stifle the economy, stifle your transportation modes because that will kill this economy in Minnesota, which is struggling today with the current situations that we're in. And if we put another damper on transportation and getting goods to market and getting goods out to the nation and the global market, you will stifle this and you will see our enterprises go elsewhere in this state and in the country. Thank you.
So we're going to have three more questions. Representative Kraft, Senator Jasinski, and then Representative Cagle, and then we'll move on to public testimony. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question here and a few comments first. I think I heard a question of around highways and air pollution. And let's just be clear. MnDOT can certainly provide the data, but there's all kinds of studies out there. American Lung Association, living near a busy roadway exposes residents to a complex mixture of harmful pollutants that includes nitrogen oxides, particle pollutions, and VOCs coming from the tailpipes of cars, trucks, and buses. Okay? The EPA, air pollutants from cars, trucks, and other motor vehicles are found in higher concentrations near major roads. So we can get the specifics, but it's just a fact that living near a busy highway exposes people to more air pollution. Kind of straightforward. So let's realize that's the case. I also want to appreciate what Representative Sensenmura said starting this off, that we're in the process of rethinking highways and rethinking our transportation system. A really simple example is that historically, you thought, boy, if there's congestion on a highway, let's add some lanes. But what studies have shown is that doesn't work. It may resolve for a couple of years, but it induces demand. And then in a few years after that, you're in the same situation, if not worse, because then you have more pollution. So I think this is a really complex process, and I appreciate the care you're taking. I would encourage you, I heard concerns about the models being used, to work with folks to really refine those. I don't know what the right solution is, but you know, maybe it's something very different than what we envision today. So how are you making sure in your process that you're bringing in and open to things that may look very different than what historically we've thought of in this process? Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. We are looking at the models. We've done a sensitivity analysis as to how the modeling might be affected, particularly post-COVID. We know that travel patterns changed, the way people move changed. So we are taking care with our models to make sure that we are considering what might happen in the future. How are we considered? We have included the at-grade alternative as part of our alternatives. We're looking at a very large universe, a holistic number of alternatives, everything from at-grade signalized 94, reducing the freeway. We talked about putting a lid over the freeway and just having another roadway on top. We're talking about expanding the freeway. We need to understand the outcomes of each of those, and that's part of it. We're also doing nationwide reviews, looking at other locations that have reviewed freeways, or I'm sorry, reduced freeways or turned them into signalized roadways to make sure we're understanding what's happening around the country. We have not found one similar to 94, nowhere near the same volume.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. And then our final question for Chair Cagle.
Not so much a question, but
I'm sorry, Senator Jasinski, and then Chair Cagle. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just kind of following up on Senator Howell's kind of comments on that. You know, all the modeling looks good. The pictures look nice. But if you look at the pictures, all the truck traffic is gone. And that's a huge truck corridor there. There's probably, I think, what I've heard is 4,600 to 6,500 freight vehicles going through there delivering goods to people and things like that. In the pictures, those trucks all disappear. And it all looks nice. I like that. But we have to transfer commerce across the thing. And healthcare, emergency vehicles. I mean, I've driven on 94, many, many emergency vehicles. That's a fast way to get emergency vehicles through there. It's important for that. There's health campuses in Minneapolis and St. Paul that this corridor provides a huge asset to get those connectivity there. So, again, my concern, along with Senator Howe, is that there's a lot of commerce traveling there. There's a lot of needs for health care, for emergency vehicles. And so that was my one concern. Then going back to the compensation, I was just involved with Highway 14 a few years ago. We got a four-lane, and there was a lot of acquisitions by property owners. Farmers, the same thing. They, you know, didn't feel they got paid what they should, and I get that. It's a family farm. A lot of farmers ended up going, instead of going a quarter mile to their field, now have to travel 5 miles around to get to the field. So any kind of improvements to our arterial roadways are going to have impact no matter where it is, if it's in the metro or if it's in rural Minnesota. So I think they're compensated. They do many, many appraisals. I was an appraiser at one time, so I know there's appraisals and things like that done. Usually there's two done, so you have one, two different opinions, and then they go in between. I think that's the same way it was done back then. So they are fair market value compensations, but everybody has that feeling that, you know, for some impact. It could be a farmer in rural Minnesota, or it could be a black family in Minneapolis. So I totally understand both sides. But my big concern is the freight, the commerce, and what it'll do to our economy in this area. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Jasinski. And now our last question to Chair Cagle.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein. So, Mike, just a couple comments. I think one of the things about the displacement of folks in Rondo is that we also displace generational wealth, and so some of that can't be quantified. And then I also want to just say that I share a lot of the concerns that have been laid out here, but I'm very happy that Ms. Barnes and Ms. Coppy are working on this. I'm sure Representative West can attest to the fact that they were part of the process on 65 and going through that Pell process and really getting the feedback from the community. It was a really wonderful process, and so I think that all of the concerns will be addressed through this Pell process, and the right alternative will eventually come out. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to everybody who testified. We now have public testimony, and we can go a little after 10, but the room will be needed for another committee. So I just want to let folks know we won't really be able to get to everybody, but if the testifiers could keep their testimony to 2 minutes, that means we can get more folks in, and we'll remind you about the 2 minute. We'll give you the 2 minute, not warning, but 2 minute stop here. So first on our list is Reverend Pittman. And then after Reverend Pittman, we have Robin Hickman Winfield.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Pastor Richard Pittman with the NAACP. the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. I believe the testimony today and the things that I hear and the concerns, I believe Reconnect Rondo can work. As it's been said, that there have been several questions about the equity of how it will affect travel, how it would affect our commerce, our economics. Also, I love the last statement made by the individual that stated that we as a community, the displacement, the economic loss, the issues that have affected our community and that are still affecting our community today. And I believe over time, nothing has particularly been totally ironed out, but I believe in development. I believe that with all the intelligent people here in the room today, that we can figure out a way to make it work that is equitable for Rondo and everybody, commerce, everything, the highway, everything involved. I believe it can be done. One of the things that I feel when we deal with education, and just to mention one thing, you know, it affected the Rondo community so bad that one thing that hurt me is that the disproportionate of our young people in our communities, we know there's an issue in our communities with our young people, the lack of opportunity, lack of economic advances. And I'm all for progress, I'm all for those things, but when it affects the community of people and it makes them marginalized or disadvantaged, that's an issue with me, that's a problem to me. We found out on last year that here in the state of Minnesota, our BIPOC and Black communities in education, it came in the lowest in the nation. We were the lowest educational achievement gap in the nation. And these are issues that sometimes economics, opportunity, jobs, homes, placement, not just giving people affordable housing, but also providing them with the possibility of ownership. Just to cut my statement a little short, just to say, I was at a seminar a while back, and I heard a story about the fence where they gave the shorter guy two boxes. They gave the medium-high guy one box. A tall guy could already see over the fence. I think we need to re-envision, as Reconnect Rondo has been doing, and I've sat in many sessions with them, and I think they have a good plan, a successful plan, that with people that, when the freeway came through Rondo, and just continue, I have family members that were displaced. I think sometimes if you're not connected to the community, it's hard to understand the issues and how it affected people and how they suffered. Generationally, they were put at a disadvantage, and they lost a lot. And I think we need to re-envision and reconnect and come up with strategies and ways instead of fighting against but working together to make those things happen. But I think that the possibility of removing the fence, and I know my time is almost up, removing that fence so that everybody has an equal playing field, an equal opportunity to see the full landscape of the land. And I believe if we bring this educational, economical, and all these disadvantaged things that took place at the displacement of Rondo, I grew up in that community, I went to school in that community, I was raised in that community, and I'm still living in that community. I see the effects of what it has done to the people there and the displacement of our young people and our families and generationally. And I just want to end with this statement, and I'll get out the way, allow somebody else to come. Dr. King made a statement. It's a very powerful statement. This is not meant as an insult to anybody here today. It's not meant as an insult to anybody, so don't take it personally unless you feel like you need to. But say, one of the most dangerous things in the world is to be sincerely ignorant and conscientiously stupid. We have to be careful how we try to outthink something that would benefit a group of people, because we've been displaced and marginalized as a Black people for so long that we really need to think about ways we can work together to make these things work so it benefits not just one group of people, but all groups. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next, we have Robin Hickman Winfield, followed by Anika Bowie and Sandra Hunter. And again, we'll really try, let's try hard to keep it short so we can get more people in.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Hornstein and the committee. I just want to make a correction. My name is Anika Bowie. I actually am a St. Paul City Council member of Ward 1. So this project of rethinking I-94 actually goes through my ward. I'm here today because I am from Rondo. My family spent a century of 100 years here in Rondo. My dad has stories of talking about playing in the dirt, when they uprooted Rondo Avenue, and when it rained, his shoes got stuck in there. So I think maybe probably a million years from now, he'll probably have a historical archive in that field. But I'm here today as a city council member to speak to this comprehensive plan and the plan that Reconnect Rondo has been working on for decades. I have seen them in the community engaging with our stakeholders, making sure that we not only just have a plan for a highway or a land bridge, but this is a plan that's going to ensure that we are revitalizing the economy in that neighborhood. We're also ensuring that we're creating opportunities for shared ownership and building wealth. Here, in my capacity as a city council member, I often am voting on establishing districts, right? And I am in support of establishing a historical or heritage art district to allow us to use historical state credit so we can have that great level of investment in Rondo that's so deserved. A couple weeks ago, I had the opportunity, along with my colleagues on the council, along with the support of Mayor Carter, to establish the renaming of Concordia Avenue and St. Anthony Avenue, which runs parallel with I-94. That now is permanently changed back to Rondo Avenue. So in middle of April, we'll have that as a permanent street name change. But again, I just want to say thank you so much for the critical questions. I'm here to be a thought partner on ensuring that we're establishing this district, to ensure that we're establishing not only preserving the history, but giving people the credits and the level of investment for them to preserve their wealth and build generational wealth, as Mr. Anderson and other stakeholders have shared.
Thank you so much for your testimony. And now, Robin Hickman Winfield, and then Sandra Hunter and Charles Rifong Longden.
Good morning. Hi, Chair Horstein and committee. Actually, my name is Makia Griffin.
Oh.
And I come in several capacities. I am the co-chair of the Rondo Roundtable. I'm also the executive director of Rondo Community Land Trust. And more importantly, I'm a daughter of Rondo. I always like to say that the freeway lulled me to sleep. My bedroom in the house I grew up on, St. Anthony, faced the freeway. And my family was physically separated by the highway. I had family on both sides of the freeway. And we had to, when I was a kid, had to ride my bike across a rickety little catwalk to get to the other side, to visit my other family, my cousins that were on the other side of the freeway. I have heard so many stories about the harms and the impact, but I've also known that there's been a great resiliency in the community at the same time. And yes, there are some very critical questions that need to be answered and thought through, but I would like to say that the work that is that's happening with the Reconnect Rondo is that is something that's been going on for over the last 10 years, longer than 10 years, since 2009, when there was an apology in regard to what happened and the devastation that happened through 94. And so at this point, I just really want to say, while there are very many great ideas that have come to fruition as we've talked here, it is the birth of what the community has said it wanted in response to what it was promised as with the infrastructure and the cap that we are looking at placing on top of the freeway, which I think would answer to a lot of different questions that were raised today, but also allow for the community I grew up in, to be able to have its say on how it wants to see its remediation and what it wants in terms of how it wants to move forward. And so I really want to thank you for all the support that you've given to Reconnect Rondo and its studies that are needed and to the community. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Sandra Hunter, Charles Freepong Longden, and Lisa Nelson.
Hi, I'm Sandra Hunter, and I just, a point of information. I actually heard a program about transportation on Minnesota Public Radio about the Federal Defense Act, and actually, according to this program and the expert who was speaking, the plans for the freeway system preceded the National Defense Act by a long time. It was already planned, and then that came into the picture later. So that might be interesting to note. And also, I heard the comment about emergency vehicles. How about just putting in a lane in for broken down in vehicles and then emergency vehicles reserved for them alone, and that would solve the problem. But I'm here because there are national and international studies about the harms of freeway of car emissions, and I am one of the victims. I have lived a very healthy life. I'm 78. I have been told I have at most 2.5 years to live. I have lymphoma, and I thought, how could that be? After the Earth Day in 1972, my husband, I was in grad school, he was in medical school, we gave away our car, and we haven't had one since. We lived in Minneapolis. I worked at that big white building next door, and I never, ever used a car. I biked, or else I took the 16A bus or the 21A bus. It is possible to get around, and I was shocked that I have this illness. It was discovered during a hip replacement surgery, and I thought, why am I having that? My bones are sound. I don't have osteoporosis. What is the deal? I haven't fallen. We discovered that I have stage 4 cancer. My bones, it's in my marrow. There is no return. My bones in my hip had rotted, and so that's been replaced, and now it's just what goes next, my liver, my kidneys, whatever. And my family physician in my last checkup said, this is amazing, you're so healthy. And then he said, it's kind of surprising because you are going to die of this cancer. So I am really healthy, and the thing that hurts me most is I can't be a blood donor, and the next time I get my driver's license, I have to take my organ donor symbol off of there because that was important to me. So I'm just saying that this affects real people, and the only alternative I see that's remotely ethical is the above grade, slowed down traffic with room for pedestrians and bicyclists and buses to give people alternatives. I did hear the PAC meeting on Zoom last Wednesday for MnDOT, and I was surprised because one question was asked by a member, have we considered not having a freeway, turning it into a green space or something else, or giving it back to the neighborhoods? And they said, no, our charge is just to remodel it. And then there was a question that said, have we looked at international models? And the answer was no. And I thought, good heavens, we have neat ideas like the latest one for the snow fences that are solar too. Wonderful. But the action is in other countries. And people I've met on the street and in the grocery store have said, tell them about Singapore where cars are virtually not outlawed. Tell them about Copenhagen where the transit system, you get a card that's connected to an account, and you show the same card whether you're on a train, a bus, a tram, inner city travel, whatever, it debits your account. And as you use it more frequently, the fares go down to reward you.
Thank you so much. And I'm sorry for your
That's okay.
Situation. No. And but thank you for sharing your
But global warming
story.
Is a big thing. And the species, including us, are going to die. We have to do something.
Thank you.
I'm not going to be around to see it, but.
Thank you for coming down. Charles Freepong Longden, followed by Lisa Nelson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Charles Freepong Longden, Jr. Greetings, Chair Hornstein and members. My name is Charles Freepong Longden, Jr. I'm a community organizer speaking on today on behalf of the Minnesota Environmental Justice Table and as a resident of St. Paul located near the I-94 corridor. I'm coming to you to speak on the effects of on this issue of on environmental justice and public health. As an organizer, I have dedicated my life to removing obstacles and co-creating solutions. We have a unique opportunity in the form of this project to undertake both. We must repair the I-94's impact on public health and quality of living. Rebuilding the freeway would only perpetuate significant harm done to these communities in the far future. Highways have many severe negative health impacts, including increased rates of asthma, dementia, cancer, and stunted growth. Major highway projects also have a storied history rooted in systemic racism that continues to target and harm marginalized communities. Without community consent, they've divided neighborhoods, demolished homes, and paved over third spaces where our communities congregated. Restitutions for these actions can never be one-to-one. We recognize this because it is impossible to put an accurate valuation upon lives lost or lives detrimentally affected. But we also can consider the will of the people and the needs of those most affected by a history of environmental violence. This is an opportunity for us to change for the better. Legislators must act this session to address health and racial disparities by passing new cumulative impact laws that include major highway projects in environmental justice communities. We are at a juncture in which we must take bold action across all sectors to ensure our communities can breathe freely and easily. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your testimony. Lisa Nelson, followed by Eric Harris-Bernstein.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein, for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Lisa Nelson. I've been following this project closely as co-chair of my district council's transportation committee, and I live one block north of I-94 in St. Paul. The street I live on has about 20 kids in a two-block stretch right next to the highway. When you talk about the I-94 project area a quarter mile from the highway, that's our neighborhood. That's where we sleep every night. When I go outside and play with my kids, we hear highway sounds and breathe highway air. We cross the highway to get to the library, the post office, and the nearest playground. The length of this entire project is 7.5 miles. At 55 miles an hour, that's 8 minutes to drive. All the kids on my street, even the babies, have each already spent more time in the Rethinking I-94 project area than a commuter would spend driving every weekday for 40 years. Designing the highway as a transportation project first and figuring out livability later prioritizes the convenience of drivers over the health and safety of people who live here every day. All the way back in 2018, MnDOT identified safety, noise, air quality, and lack of connections across the highway as among the major concerns for this project, but I don't see those priorities reflected in the proposed alternatives or in this entire process. I ask you to ensure that MnDOT doesn't just leave room or opportunity for livability, but instead design something that meets the needs and priorities of our communities along the highway. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Eric Harris-Bernstein, followed by Sam Rockwell.
Chair Hornstein, members of the committee, my name is Eric Bernstein. First up, I need to correct a slanderous lie in the committee documents. I was listed as a St. Paul resident. I actually live in South Minneapolis. Sorry.
Oh, boy.
Only kidding. So I'm a lobbyist for my day job. I work for I run a labor grassroots coalition that advocates for public investment in a wide range of public services from child care to education. But I'm actually here just as a Minnesota resident. I think this is an enormously important decision. We made this decision once in the last century, and we're going to make it once again now. How do we deal with traffic moving through the cities, and what is our society going to look like in the next 50 or 100 years? Doing anything different than what we have now in the status quo is hard to imagine, but as we heard today, what we did 50 years ago was also unthinkable. In a bad way, and I think we have a chance to do something different now. I just want to kind of, in my work, I advocate for public investment, like I said, in childcare, education, housing, all these things that we hope will improve society. And I have a great amount of faith in what those investments can do. But I think, when I advocate for more spending on these different items, there's something that kind of falls out of it is this physical environment that all of these investments are built on. So the way I sort of think about it is, if our investments in education and childcare and healthcare are our steps towards a better world, then our physical infrastructure is the ground we're walking across as we go forward. And I think that when we build our physical infrastructure in a way that inherently divides us,
that takes people out of the city, that takes people off of the streets, we make that job a lot more difficult on ourselves. We've heard about health impacts. We've heard about social impacts. We've heard about economic impacts. And if we double down on that decision now, our society will look almost identical today, in 50 years to what it looks like today. And when we think about climate change, we think about problems in our urban environments, I think that would be a big mistake. So I understand that it takes a lot of vision and sort of a lot of bravery to consider anything other than the status quo, but the status quo is very harmful, and I think it's easy to just continue that. So I'm really asking you to look at this very, very closely. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Sam Rockwell, Amanda Dewar, and then Marta Struve.
Thank you, committee members. Thank you, Chair Hornstein, not only for the opportunity to speak today, but for your leadership over the years. I'm thrilled to be here in your first committee hearing after your announcement. Congratulations. My name is Sam Rockwell. I am Executive Director of Move Minnesota Action. And, I want to just reiterate a few points that have been made. You know, this is a generational opportunity before the legislature, before MnDOT, before our communities, right? In the last 50, 70 years, we made audacious decisions to build out the interstate highway system. And that was an era of great connectivity, but also great harm. And now we have this opportunity to take another audacious move to build connectivity in a different way and to remedy that harm. We took a first step, you took a first step last session in passing a bill to reduce vehicle miles traveled and greenhouse gas emissions in our highways. And this is an opportunity to show what that looks like on a corridor. This is an opportunity to show how we can change how we move around, not limit mobility, but change how we move, change how our communities are structured to better foster community health, connections, and more. You know, we can show how the question should not be whether we can do this, right? The question should be how we can do this. We have seen, we heard from a testifier earlier, that there are cities around the world where we don't have interstate highways coming into the center of those cities. Vibrant cities, healthy cities, cities with enormous GDPs, cities where freight is able to get in where it needs to go. This is about thinking differently. This is about understanding possibility and thinking big. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rockwell. And then Amanda Dewar and Marta. And then Katie Nicholson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Amanda Dewar, and I'm the Vice President of Government Affairs for the St. Paul Area Chamber. As several around the table know, I spent the early days of my career working for the Transportation Committee and the other body, and so it's always a bit of a homecoming and fun to be here. So thank you. The St. Paul Area Chamber and many of our members support the Reconnect Rondo initiative and the efforts to reconnect a vibrant neighborhood disrupted by the construction of I-94, the effects of which are still being felt today. We also recognize that Reconnect Rondo is a separate process from the long-term reimagining of I-94 and includes so much more than just transportation infrastructure, including an African-American cultural enterprise district with housing, economic development, and the arts. The St. Paul Area Chamber is also actively engaged in the rethinking I-94 process. I myself serve on the Community Leaders Panel and can attest to a very comprehensive engagement process. Given my background and direct experience, I'd like to raise a few points. The I in I-94 stands for interstate. I-94 stretches from Michigan to Montana, so changes from a highway to an at-grade boulevard have impacts beyond the project area. From MnDOT's draft purpose and needs statement, the program area sees daily traffic between 114 and 167,000 vehicles a day. That's to say that this highway, while vitally important to the surrounding communities and neighborhood, also serves as an important corridor of commerce. Our members and businesses throughout the state and region use this stretch of highway to transport their products. Their employees use this highway to get to work, and families use it to get to sporting events, restaurant, and other commercial activities. So just want to raise a few practical considerations. Should the project area be turned into a boulevard, it would no longer be part of the interstate system. I-94 would likely have to be rerouted elsewhere, thus disrupting another neighborhood within the metro. The FHWA and likely MnDOT would not maintain ownership or control if the interstate was replaced by a boulevard. Are Ramsey and Hennepin County and the city of Minneapolis and St. Paul willing to take on the cost of maintaining the boulevard? I could go on, but I know I'm done. So I'll just say there's much to consider.
Thank you very much, Ms. Sewer. Marta, followed by Katie Nicholson, and hopefully we'll have time for Erica Lee.
Hello, I'm Marta Struvey. I am a lifelong resident of the Twin Cities Metro, a current resident of Minneapolis, and an environmental engineering student at the University of Minnesota. And I'm here to advocate for some of the highway removal and boulevardization options on the Rethinking I-94 project, both as a student and a future civil engineer. I would like to remind the engineers in the room and state for the non-engineers in the room that the first duty of civil engineers is to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public, and boulevard and highway removal options are the most ethical options in the Rethinking I-94 project because they reconnect marginalized communities, increase transit options, and transition away from car-centered infrastructure, which is essential to the current and future well-being of Twin Cities residents. We are feeling the impacts of climate change now, and the pressure to move towards sustainable options is growing, and the boulevard replacement of I-94 would help create climate resiliency and allow the Twin Cities to be a model for sustainable urban transportation. I fear the other options cement the Twin Cities in an outdated metropolitan model that will continue the cycle of unsupportive and aged public infrastructure in Minnesota. I urge the committee and MnDOT to prove their commitment to their self-stated goals of sustainability and equity in transportation and other goals by choosing boulevardization and other highway removal options, including highway caps. Please prioritize environmental and racial justice in your decision-making and help start a new era of transportation in the Twin Cities and take direct action to reverse the harm done by Interstate 94. I would also like to advocate for these alternatives and make you think outside the box as a student and as a member of the University of Minnesota community and acknowledge that the division that Highway I-94 has caused from the university to the surrounding areas has caused economic harm to both the surrounding area and students, and that reconnecting them can bring benefits to both students and surrounding community members. Thank you
very much. So we'll have two more, Katie Nicholson, and then we'll end with Erica Lee. And my apologies for those who were planning to testify, but we will certainly take your written testimony on the record. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein and members of the committee. My name is Katie Nicholson. I'm here partially on behalf of the I-94 Rail Coalition, but I really do want to talk about myself while I'm up at the podium mostly. I'll try to condense my testimony, but essentially I'm someone who grew up in the suburbs knowing car dependency. Urban and suburban renters are forced to live along these busy corridors, along some of our busiest corridors, both freeways and surface streets. I grew up in Burnsville, one of the most car-dependent places here in the Twin Cities Metro. And I remember being forced to cross busy streets, busy arterials, living along freeways, and those have a ton of impacts, including pollution and noise impacts. And really, I do want to say one thing about the MnDOT people who are up here, and I encourage looking at 494 and 694 because there is a high concentration of renters along that freeway loop as well, and I don't want those people to be left out of a conversation like this as well. But as we all know, 94 was terribly impacted our community. It destroyed one of our most productive corridors in the Twin Cities. It destroyed a well-established, well-known Black community, and I think that is something that we really, really do need to take into consideration. I personally believe that the freeway should just be outright removed. But of course, you know, we're here now. And proposals like the Rondo Land Bridge and the Twin Cities Boulevard do at least help us reclaim some of that land back for businesses, for residents. Really, I mean, this is about people. This is about people who are impacted every single day by these just horrible freeways, by these horrible arterials. And renters, low-income people, we bear the brunt of this car dependency. We are forced to live in this world of car dependency, whether or not we want it, whether or not we want to be part of this. So I really do encourage different options along the 94 corridor. I think that this is going to be a really, really important project. And we need to not just consider cars. There's been a significant lack of high quality, you know, much better transportation options, particularly rail options. I keep hearing a lot of talk about how we've invested in this central corridor, University Avenue. The Green Line's not going to be good enough. We can make more investments on the 94 corridor. We need to think big with a project like this. We need to think beyond just cars. We need to actually think about the real people who are being impacted by these freeways, by car dependency, by these polluting, dangerous roads.
Thank you for your testimony. And finally, we'll end with Erica Lee.
Thank you all for your time. Okay, so my name is Erica Lee, and I'm a part of an internship made possible by Reconnect Rondo. So on behalf of the Reconnect Rondo Youth Council, I would like to highlight the ways in which youth have been involved in the project and how we have benefited from the experience. Ultimately, the youth are the greatest beneficiaries of future transportation policy. We are the people who are going to inherit the transportation policy decisions that have been made right now. We are key stakeholders and therefore need to be a part of the process. During this internship, we have learned about the history of Rondo and the legacy that it has left in American music, art, and politics. We have gained our knowledge through researching, writing, interviewing Rondo community members, and creating a 6-episode podcast that honors Rondo's past, present, and future. The Reconnect Rondo Youth Council is also in the process of developing a social media presence to reach a broader and younger audience. Through engaging content that informs and also pushes people to be conscious of the systemic injustices around them, we hope to elevate Rondo as a community with not just a past, but also a present and a bright future ahead. As someone who is part of this project but not from Rondo, it has been important for me to truly educate myself about this beloved community and get to know the people that make it what it is. Through outreach work events at events like Rondo Night or the Slow Whirl, where folks bike together around Rondo, I've been able to develop beautiful relationships. It has truly been an honor. Thank you all for your time.
Thank you. And thank you for everybody for coming. Sorry we went over time. I appreciate the large level of interest in this. And again, if you had written testimony, please submit it to our committee administrator, Matt Bauman. Thank you, Senator Dibble, for your presence here, and Senator Jasinski, and all of the senators and House members from both sides of the aisle. This meeting is adjourned.